Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta. The visible horizon of our universe is a giant ball, billions of light years across, and billions of years old. It is so vast, so dark, and so mysterious that a common reaction is to wonder whether human life itself is meaningless. We explore the place and the purpose of the human person in the entirety of the cosmos with Dr. Timothy Kearns. Dr. Timothy Kearns is professor of Western civilization and writing at the Legion of Christ College of Humanities in Connecticut. He is also the author of On the Place and Purpose of Humankind in the Cosmos, published in the Logos Journal, a journal of Catholic thought and culture. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, no. The honor is all ours. So I want to start by asking, this was a really brilliantly written article, by the way, and you made it very accessible, which I really appreciate. But I want to ask you, what prompted you to think about this particular lens of viewing the human person?
Oh, that's a great question. So the main reason, or the main thing that prompted me in this, I would say, is really kind of two things that go together, one of which is the call that a number of popes in the 20th and 21st century have made for Catholic theologians and philosophers to articulate a renewed vision of the cosmos, you know, a framework of knowledge and things like that to help us all see how our faith relates to and is manifested in and also perfects kind of the whole of nature. So that is part of what kind of directed me toward this set of interests. Mm-hmm. But then I think at a personal level, you know, I remember, I'm actually a convert to Catholicism, but I remember being a Protestant and confronting the sciences to a certain degree, you know, and then thinking to myself something like this, you know, how do we as humans fit into the larger order of the world?
Right.
If you follow the story of Christ, you know, it seems kind of obvious. And in a way, there's not a lot of questions. He comes to save us and to redeem us and all that. And that's great, obviously. But on the other hand, I just couldn't help but seeing a kind of dissonance on that. I remember mm-hmm. one evening in particular, here in Connecticut, some of the houses are set up such that you have to like go outside to go around to go into the basement to do the laundry or something. Uh-huh. So this one night, I was carrying the laundry out after, you know, it was all dark, and our particular place at that time was more in the country, so I could see the stars. And I remember carrying, you know, this big basket of laundry and just standing there on the stairs, just staring out at the heavens. And I remember two specific instances. One, I kind of was struck by almost the meaninglessness of the whole, you know, in the sense that I could see it with merely, if I may say it, merely modern eyes. Mm-hmm. You know, I could look out and see nothing, you know, and no meaning and no purpose. And that really sent me on a kind of quest personally, maybe to really see how to address that concern for ordinary people, not even just people in the, you know, in the church, but if there's a way to address it somewhat more generally. And then a few months later, I was able, through a number of conferences I went to and whatnot, I had some ideas about how to do it. And like what the right way to see this is, you know,
right.
And I remember going back outside one night and happened to be the same situation. And I wasn't even thinking about it. I just happened to look up and saw again the stars, but now with new eyes, you know, I could really see. And I just sort of stood there for a while, you know, very overwhelmed with God's grace of at least some connecting some insights from, you know, other sources like the Fathers and St. Thomas. So I think those two components kind of met together in my research on this paper.
And I'm really glad that you shared that, because that shows that this is not only an intellectual pursuit, and rightly so it is, but there's also a deeply personal component that in writing this, you and I, me as a reader, you as the author, are really prompted to consider our place as human persons in light of the grand scheme of ecology and the cosmos.
Yeah, no, you're right. Definitely.
So to that end then, Tim, I actually want to address exactly what you said, the futility of it all. It's so easy. And even when we look at scripture, you think about Mark 13:31, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words will not. And we know here that heaven doesn't mean the eternal dwelling place of God, but heaven as in the heavens, right? When Jesus said that, he's basically implying that there is a terminus to material creation. We know from what we know about the sciences that there's an entropic terminus to the entirety of existence as we know it. It's easy then, from a purely naturalistic empiricist view, to say, therefore, that, gosh, you know, all this is going to end anyways, nothing matters. But in light of that, you find that there really is a place for the human person. So expand that thought for us.
Sure, sure. No, this is precisely what I believe I've been able to discover in this, and been confirmed with some other work that I've done with other scholars in other disciplines. The basic insight that I was trying to pursue was, if humankind has a nature, then we as a species should fit into the order of the world in some way, just in a purely natural, from a purely natural perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we have more than a nature. We also have supernature, and our destiny is beyond this world. But nevertheless,
right.
it is a worldly, you know, sort of thing. We have animality. At least I guess we would say to a perfect degree,
mm-hmm.
beyond perfection, in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I sort of was wrestling with is that there must be a way to see this in the natural order of the world. And so what I remember specifically spending time with is the disciplines of medicine and agriculture, horticulture, and veterinary medicine. I remember spending a lot of time, especially at the American Catholic Philosophical Association meeting in 2015, which was in Boston at the Boston Park Hotel there. I remember thinking a lot about those four disciplines and how those reveal something about the human person that nothing else in the whole of the created order, even just from the purely scientific natural perspective, has. There's this capacity that we have to relate to other things in a way that pursues their flourishing,
mm-hmm.
helps them to realize their potential, not simply our own. And so the more I pursued that down,
mm-hmm.
the more I also came to see that it's not just a question of the fact that we have this capacity, although that we have that capacity, but it's also implied by our nature.
Right.
For the simple reason that we need suitable, sustainable environments to live in. We need natural resources. We need animals. We need plants. We need the phytoplankton in the oceans that produce
mm-hmm.
the oxygen, you know? And so our pursuit of flourishing entails our maintenance of the flourishing of all these other things in the natural world as far as possible, because without them, we wouldn't be able to survive either. So in a way, then, it just this is to kind of put the argument just in a simple term. We can expand on this in other ways if you'd like. But that therefore means that the pursuit of stewardship is part of what we are, just as a species naturally considered.
Right.
That is stewardship of the natural world within certain limits. You know, we have to be careful because we're an animal among many animals, you know, so it doesn't mean we have to preserve everything statically or anything
mm-hmm,
like that. But
mm-hmm, right.
This stewardship is part of what we are. And that was really the big stroke for me. That's what helped me to kind of make sense of all these other pieces.
And Tim, you know, it's wonderful that you highlighted in exactly that way, because a hierarchical, systematic way of viewing the world and all of creation means that we can actually see a certain dignity of the human person. Like you mentioned, we have nature, but we also have supernature. And that puts us in a kind of perfection that's greatly elevated than the animals. We are not like the animals. The animals are not kin to us. They're not one in nature with us in a real sense. So on the one hand, sure, we do have that call of stewardship. As you mentioned very rightly, stewardship points towards something more than nature. But on the other hand, as you also highlight in your article, we are not, if you will, subservient to nature and the cosmos. In fact, as stewards, there's a kind of authority of dominion over nature, over the cosmos.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so, yeah, develop that, please. Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
No, I wanted to ask you to develop on that.
Yeah, so I think the right way to develop that is to first say what it's not.
Mm-hmm.
When we say this, people might immediately say, oh, gosh, here we go. You know, more people talking about how the West can dominate the rest. And I think the key is the word dominium.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to Aquinas' Latin, he uses the word dominium. What does that word mean? We say dominion. We say dominate, right? Those mm-hmm. are both not appropriate translations for this word.
Mm-hmm.
Dominium, in its root sense, refers to a household, to a place where people live, where life is held, where a place that is a home for us. And we can use that term home analogous with other species. You know, mm-hmm. beavers have homes. Birds have homes in their own way. Of course, it's not exactly the same as ours, but nevertheless, it's still the same analogous idea. So I would say that when we focus on that word, on the precise term, then we're able to say that this is not meant to be a dominion in perhaps the way of many modern people, for example, Francis Bacon might use that term.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's rather meant to be a dwelling in that dwells in as a home, but yet that also doesn't take away from the reality of our capacities as directed toward the other things.
Right.
So we essentially combine, we say both and. We say it's both a home and a place where we are able to care for and direct, ideally, although of course we don't do it perfectly, right? The rest of the natural world. And the fact that we have these capacities, I would say, shows, even if we don't always use them well, that is the role that we play in the natural world.
Right. And therein lies that key distinction, that in doing so, in being good stewards, in practicing this right dominion, like you mentioned, the root of the term, even in the Summa written in Latin, is domus. Domus means house in Latin, right? And mm-hmm. so the stewardship of our mutual home, our collective home, as the Holy Father states in Laudato Si, it really draws us to the fact that there is this right hierarchy, and so man stands, if you will, as stewards in the place of God. And so we will be held to account before God for this stewardship. But at the same time, we also have an obligation to not then make nature our God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're going to continue this line of conversation with Dr. Timothy Kearns, Professor of Western Civilization and Writing at the Legion of Christ College of Humanities in Connecticut. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the Afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta. My guest is Dr. Timothy Kearns, Professor of Western Civilization and Writing at the Legion of Christ College of Humanities in Connecticut. We're discussing his article on the place and purpose of humankind in the cosmos, published in the Logos Journal of Catholic Thought and Culture. So, Tim, we were discussing earlier that, on the one hand, proper acknowledgement of our place in the hierarchy of creation means that man has an obligation of stewardship. And this obligation, as you mentioned, is not just in nature. There's a kind of supernatural reality to our stewardship. On the other hand, however, when God is taken out of the picture, the hierarchy completely gets skewed, and you find that man goes back to a kind of pagan animism and this worship of nature. And we see that rearing its ugly head even in secular culture to some degrees. So expand on that.
Sure. Yeah, I think the principal difficulty is just this. If you don't have something transcendent on which to anchor yourself and your vision of the world, then you don't have nothing. You have something that's immanent, which is the cosmos itself,
mm-hmm.
the various aspects of the metaphysical reality, the spiritual reality that people can see. So, you know, the works of angels and demons that are, you know, actually take place, and you have those all, you know, as kind of matter for your reflection on how to understand your place in the world. And of course, they're all, many of those aspects are beautiful and powerful, and they speak of their creator. They manifest their creator. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have if you limit yourself to what is imminent, then you're left with something that can easily be focused so much on what you see in front of you that it loses all sense of anything beyond, and then begins to even twist out of proportion what you actually see.
Right.
I think that one important piece in this is to note the difference between, say, the reaction of a traditional religion, like maybe the religion of people of the ancient Near East, or you know, some of these other even foraging cultures, to see their reaction, broadly speaking, as much as we can, to phenomena, to transformations, that kind of thing, and to compare that reaction with contemporary people who might be more interested in New Age stuff or drawn toward more spiritualist things. Because at least the foraging societies, you know, people who are Hindu or people who are, you know, did in the past practice the religion of ancient Egypt or whatever, they have so much of a tradition, so much, so long a time that they've been reflecting on this, that they, although they make mistakes, of course, and they you know, end up worshiping realities that are not gods,
right,
they nevertheless are moored, if I can use that word, they're sort of moored to the world. One of the problems we face in our culture is that people of the more kind of New Age perspective or spiritual, you know, who are, have a more a focus on that kind of thing, are simply, and from the natural world even.
Right, exactly. So when you take the true, transcendent, omnipotent, omniscient God, who is himself not within his creation, he is external to his creation, and he holds creation in being. When you take that premise out of the equation, you run the risk of either, as you mentioned, becoming part of the pagan animistic culture, the culture, the foraging culture, and the religions that come out of that. But on the flip side, you can also seek to ascribe to this created reality and an overt sense of transcendence and spiritualism, all in the effort of seeking an ontological value, because that which is truly ontological has been cast out of the equation. So just dive deeper into that.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. When you take what is supposed to be the foundation and remove it for whatever reason, and say what you will about, you know, ancient Near Eastern or other religions, they're not post-Christian. I mean, in a certain clear sense, they're pre-Christian. Mm-hmm. So, but when you have specifically chosen to reject this larger tradition for whatever reason, you're choosing to embrace something that cannot fulfill even the original mission that you have in mind for it. You know, if you take, for example, someone who I encountered this online somewhere recently, a person who claims to have embraced the Old Norse mythology of, you know, of Odin and, and things like that. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. It's totally true. But it can't be, it can only be a consumerist decision to make. You can only enter into that in a way that is configured by, or is changed by, the fact of our contemporary culture, in which you can make that kind of choice.
Right.
If you want to be an Old Norse Viking, you can choose it. You know, for Vikings themselves, you didn't get that choice.
Right.
You know, religion was a fighting matter. They fought over Christianity. They made a public political decision in Iceland, for example, to embrace the faith. You know, so all these things are not, in fact, truly Old Norse, if you act in those ways. It's rather just a kind of potted version of it that you keep in the corner of your room.
Right.
You know, between Comic-Con and your 40-hour, you know, you play the game. And that's okay in a certain sense. You can read much of their literature, and it can be very beautiful, but for something transcendent, it's not going to satisfy you in the long run.
Exactly. And like you mentioned, the reclamations of these pre-Christian faith systems, these foraging systems, or in this case, you know, reclamation of the Norse system. There's also a resurgence of the Greek mythological system that's rearing itself in Western civilization right now, which is really funny to think about, because the very reason that all these pagan ideologies died out was because the fundamental understanding of God needing to be transcendent, and therefore not just loving but love itself, not just truthful but truth itself, means that he is beyond the fallacies that exist in these mythologies. So, you know, the God of Christianity is nothing like Zeus or Jupiter. You know, he is eternally Father, and Jesus Christ is from all eternity Son. Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, is eternally Son, and none of them, and the Holy Spirit, none of them are anything like the wanton depravities that we see in Zeus or in Poseidon or the like. So we've rejected the great advances of Christianity and Christendom in the interest of reclaiming these things, because we've cast them out of the public sphere. Now, I know that was a lot, but the reason why I brought that up is because you also mentioned in your article that, therefore, in order to understand the human person, we have to see this person not just in continuity with creation, which is crucial, but also different from, almost separate from creation. We are not like the rest of the created order. So build on that.
Yeah, I think the key way to see that, and I think something that many people nowadays would struggle with on this, is the precise nature of what rationality is, what the intellectual soul is in a human being. You might have thought that I would go in the direction of the divine missions to man, or man being incorporated into Christ. Those are all important points, mm-hmm. but all of that is predicated upon our nature,
right.
on what God made us to be like. And so, you know, one way to simply think of this is to imagine what it would be like to have a computer program that you created that could then come, some part of it could come to understand itself,
right.
and to understand the entire program itself from inside. I think this isn't a demonstration what I'm giving, but I think it gives us an insight that there's somehow a gap or a space that would need to be filled in such a vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that gap is what is provided for in man by the intellectual soul.
Right.
So I think particularly we can do things in the world that nothing else could. We can do things in nature that are otherwise inconceivable. I mean, to take an obvious example, which I end the article with a consideration of this. if there is some global threat to our planet or to our solar system somehow, and if we're able to know about it, what would we do? Well, mm-hmm. we would try to do something about it. We're the only ones who even conceivably could. For all the glories and all the beauties of the rest of the natural world, there is nothing else in the whole of creation, and this is a natural scientific fact, that could even consider, much less attempt to address, that kind of problem.
Right.
And that, I think, reveals our nature. I mean, you can call it sort of the Bruce Willis argument for human purpose or something. Just to immediately go to the kind of ridiculous caricature that might be made of it. But
right.
in a sense, that's true. And that's something that ordinary people can see and understand in a way that other things might require more work.
And you're completely right. I forget the name of the building, but Nakatomi Plaza, that's right. Nakatomi Plaza. So in essence, man is placed in the system as Bruce Willis in Nakatomi Plaza, and he's driving out Hans Gruber and kind of reordering the interiority of the cosmos into his right hierarchy. Now, that's a bad analogy, but I get what you mean. Because
right.
the presence of man in his intellectual nature means that there really is a kind of deus ex machina to the whole thing. And
sure.
man really is, properly speaking, a kind of divine agent, or divinely sent agent, I should say, acting upon the cosmos. So, but what I'd like you to comment on is also this, that places us in a position of real superiority to even the animals, right? We are not, like I mentioned earlier, we were not family to them. This is terrible, but even if every animal on the planet were to suddenly go extinct, it still wouldn't have the same moral implication as if every single human person went extinct. And right. that's one of the problems with religious secularism, this complete non-recognition of the true divine dignity of the human person. So we have 2 minutes. I know it's a lot, but expand on that a little more.
Yeah, I think you can see it by thinking of the analogy of a story. You know, if you think, as many people might, I suppose, in our time, you know, think of, well, what if there is no God? What if there's, you know, things are just the way the sciences describe or something? The argument that I make in the paper, I think, establishes that even in such a case, which is not true, you know, but nevertheless, for the sake of argument, we can dialectically engage with other people. Mm-hmm. Even in such a case, the loss of man would be a great tragedy because right. in a way that it wouldn't be for anything else, because we alone can A, understand the order of the world, B, act in a way to preserve it or mm-hmm. to develop it. And the simple way to see that is think of a man who's hiking and he finds a bird that's fallen out of a nest and broken its wing. And what if he turns out to be a veterinary doctor
right.
and he can set the bone and the bird can fly off? You know, there's really nothing else in the world that has those capacities in the way that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that gives us kind of a sense to, or maybe a remedy, I would say, against the kind of indifference and darkness of our time that wants us to think that we're just, not only are we just like other animals, but we're actually worse. That always
right.
seems to be the upshot.
Right.
So I think in a way, Aristotle was right when he said the corruption of the best is the worst.
Yep.
So we can be the worst, but that's only because we're the best.
Amen. And that was a fantastic way to end. Thank you so much, Tim. I've been talking to Dr. Timothy Kearns, Professor of Western Civilization and Writing at the Legion of Christ College of Humanities in Connecticut and author of this wonderful article on the place of the human person in the cosmos. I'm Marcus Peter, filling in for Al Cresta on Cresta in the afternoon.